All right, Representative Hosh, well, let's first, anybody review the minutes from February 16th? Representative Abler?
They're great, so moved that we approve them.
All right, all, any discussion? All in favor of adopting the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Everybody in favor of adopting the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
All right, all opposed, nay. All right, minutes are adopted. Representative Hosh, I will move that House File 2623 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All right, Representative Hosh.
Sounds good. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Hopefully this will be relatively quick. What House File 2623 does is allow for MA reimbursement for multiple providers at the same time in CTSS services, which is Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports. The reasoning behind this bill is because there's situations at times when medically necessary, it does make sense to have multiple providers at the same time. For example, if a child was would injure themselves, you might need to have a professional with that child doing services and also a professional there to make sure that the child is behaving in a way that is safe for everyone. If there was a case of sexual abuse or assault in the past, needing multiple providers in the same room would be something that would make sense and be beneficial. At this time, I believe there's nothing overly controversial about this bill. I am in contact with the department about some other avenues in which we can achieve the same intent, in which you could possibly use behavioral health aids or other mechanisms to make sure that the services can be provided in a more efficient way, but still through multiple providers. At this time, I would be happy to take any questions and would appreciate the committee's support.
Any discussion from members to Representative Hosh? Anybody in the audience that wants to testify about this?
Go to finance.
To finance, yeah. No, it will be.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right, seeing no discussion, all in favor, I'll renew my motion that 2623 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Thanks.
Thank you for the enthusiasm.
All right, Representative Member. Welcome to, well, you're already here, but
thank you.
Welcome again.
Thank you for welcoming me. The motion would be?
To Civil Justice, Committee on Civil Justice. So the motion, Representative Emerald will move that 2752 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Social Justice. Civil Justice. Civil Justice, sorry.
It's that
Freudian slip, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Emerald. So.
Well, welcome. Welcome. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a bill that you heard last year. It's called Ryan's Vital Records Rights Act. And just very briefly, I have Ryan's mother, Mary, with me again today. We will certainly provide whatever testimony you deem necessary, but we did have a long discussion about this last year in this committee. And briefly, what this 2752 proposes to do is, right now there is no remedy for someone who believes that a coroner's finding on death is inaccurate. That is what this seeks to change. It seeks to create a remedy allowing someone the opportunity to challenge a coroner's determination of death if they believe that it's appropriate. You may have questions about cost and the like. We did that here last year. The incidents, I think Wisconsin, we used an example of over so many years, there might have been four.
In Wisconsin, since 1985, there were 10 cases that actually went to court in 25 years.
So,
and if you can just identify yourself.
Mary Hath.
Okay, thank you.
So, and I don't mean to short-circuit it, but again, in the interest of not redoing everything that we did in hearing from the other side, that is in essence what we are doing.
And this is, we amended this last year, if I recall, from the original. This is the amended language?
I believe it is.
Okay.
Yes.
Representative Abler.
And just, I remember the testimony well, and I've talked to a number of people about this, but how many states do this besides Wisconsin?
Representative Emmer?
Two.
Okay.
Thank you.
Two other than Minnesota. I mean, yes. Two are currently doing this.
Yes, right. Wisconsin and Ohio.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Any further questions for the author, for this witness? Okay, is there anyone else that wants to testify? Ms. Thomas or Mr. Kingery? Or both together? Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Lindsay Thomas, and I am a board-certified forensic pathologist. I'm the chief medical examiner for Carver, Chisago, Dakota, Fillmore, Freeborn, Goodhue, Houston, and Scott counties. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Coroners and Medical Examiners Association in opposition to House File 2752. It appears from discussions that the primary issue here is what recourse does a family have if they disagree with a death certificate. First, what we're discussing are medical diagnoses, cause of death, and manner of death. In the medical and scientific arena, peer review is the highest form of quality assurance, not legal review. Peer review is the process of giving to a person with comparable education and experience the same exact information and material that you used when you made a decision, and then ask for their opinion and conclusion. And that's the system that's used in the medical and scientific communities. Currently, families who disagree with the medical examiner can ask them to reconsider, and medical examiners can submit the case for peer review. And if this bill became law, the incentive for peer review would be lost, because what incentive would physicians have to invest their time in peer review if their opinions could be rendered moot by a court? Clearly, this particular bill is targeting a specific medical examiner's office, but it would apply to all death certificates, most of which are signed by clinicians. So does the legislature believe that physicians should not have the final say in death records, which are used by the Minnesota Department of Health, the Center for Diseases Control and Prevention, for public health and public policy decisions? We believe that cause of death and manner of death determinations should be made by highly trained physicians using the peer review process rather than judges. The other states that have a judicial review are states that use coroners who are lay people who may or may not have any medical training or experience. Also, there is the fiscal issue. While I recognize that the state would not be footing any of these bills, the money does have to come from somewhere, and counties are certainly in no position to have this added to their burden. In conclusion, if your goal is to improve death investigation and death certification in Minnesota, your efforts would be better spent in requiring that every medical examiner's office be accredited by the National Association of Medical Examiners, rather than having accredited offices that already use rigorous quality assurance and peer review be subjected to judicial review. Thank you.
Any questions for this witness? Representative Abler.
Thank you, and I thanks. We had a nice chat just earlier today. Thanks for coming again. Does Wisconsin use coroners, or is that what they use there?
They call them coroners if they're elected. They call them medical examiners if they're appointed. But except for Milwaukee, they aren't board-certified forensic pathologists. Thank they're EMTs or nurses or realtors or...
Okay, Mr. Chair. Then the follow-up to that. So if there were 10 and 25 in Wisconsin, 10 and 25 years in Wisconsin with people who had a lower credential than most of the Minnesota ones, how do you think this is going to cause a stampede to lawsuits? How do you see that this is going to cause a chilling effect if there's only 10 claims about not good work from people who have a lower credential than most Minnesota places have? Can you answer that, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I think we just don't know what impact this would have. Certainly, as a medical examiner, I get calls from families, and right now the system that we use is we talk with the families, we offer to do peer review, we discuss it with our colleagues, and if this were in place, then I would have to say to the families, well, you can, you know, take me to court if you have concerns. So I just don't really know how often it would be used.
Mr. King.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Kingery, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. First of all, I know it's Dr. Thomas's view, and when he testified last year, Dr. Baker's view, that this is obviously a very tragic situation, and of course our sympathy goes out to the family members here. We were went on record as opposing the bill last year. Our board reviewed it and went on record again last month opposing this legislation. I'll be very quick. I know this will have another stop in which we'll probably talk more about some of the legal arguments. But again, our basic belief is that the determinations regarding cause of death are medical determinations, medical diagnosis, and they should not be replaced with a judicial opinion. As Dr. Thomas indicated, our judicial system is close to the point of breaking. We've all seen the governor's budget that was just released earlier this week. There's additional cuts to the courts, to local units of government. And our concern is that this would pull medical examiners away from their profession, from their work, and tied up at a time when the courts are being stretched, with in a time when county attorney budgets are being stretched, and we just don't think that's a good use at this time of public dollars when they're so stretched. Also, I know last year there was some discussion about what would be the burden of proof here when they go into court. I don't believe I see that in this year's bill. That might be discussion that takes place at a later date. But I think one of the things we need to consider is who would use this. It's not going to be the indigent. It's not going to be low-income folks. They're not going to be the ones that can afford the expert witnesses, the time and the money to go into court. Public defenders aren't going to help them. It's not a public defender issue, and the public defenders don't have the money anyway. So it would not be used by the poor and indigent individuals in our estimation. We think that also the concern that some of these determinations could be attacked collaterally by defendants that are found guilty and sent to prison. Where a determination may have been that the victim was a subject of a homicide, go in and challenge it. It wasn't really a homicide, it was suicide. And what does that do to the whole criminal conviction and the impact that that may have? It's happened in Ohio and again, Wisconsin. There haven't been a lot of cases. I know there are examples of in Ohio where it was attacked collaterally by individuals that were in prison. And finally, while a number of these determinations are made by medical physicians in hospitals and nursing homes and so forth, they are also made in Minnesota by medical examiners and coroners. Medical examiners are appointed by their elected county commissioners or subject to reappointment, and coroners are duly elected like county boards are. So there is some accountability for coroners and medical examiners, and I would only join in also acknowledging the concerns that were raised by Dr. Thomas. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that would conclude my testimony.
So just to follow up on that, so who makes the determination on these in Minnesota? It's not just medical examiners?
Coroners, and in some cases physicians. When you've got someone that dies in a nursing home or a hospital, unfortunately I'm familiar with that, it is made by the family physician. You know, if someone dies of cancer, that's what gets put on there.
So and so that person is not a board certified medical examiner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that would be a medical doctor.
I understand that, yeah. But we were having a distinction before about board-certified medical examiners. So there are people in Minnesota that make these determinations that aren't board-certified.
Mr. Chair, there are board-certified forensic pathologists. There are board-certified internists. There are board-certified family practice docs. Board certification refers to the type of medicine that's practiced.
Okay.
So in Minnesota, medical examiners are board-certified forensic pathologists.
Okay.
And coroners are physicians who, you know, can be any, they don't have to be forensic pathologists.
Okay. And I think that, there are some issues that are better dealt with in civil law or civil justice around the legalities. I mean, we do have all kinds of circumstances in our legal system where medical decisions are challenged all the time. But I think we don't need to go there. The real question before this committee, I think, is really the question whether the Department of Health has the capacity to deal with this issue administratively. And the civil justice issues, I think, can be dealt with. Is there anybody from the department here? Yes. Oh, and Representative Kelly, if you have a question, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kingery, you suggested that this was attacked collaterally in Ohio, a court case in Ohio. What was the result of that?
Mr. Chairman, I didn't hear your question, sir. What was...
You spoke to a collateral attack in a case in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
What was the result of that?
There was a couple of them, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. There was a couple of them. One in which the coroner had determination based on the scene that it was a suicide. It was attacked by, in this case, the family. It was determined to be a homicide, and as a result of that, they were able to access the victim's crime compensation fund. Also, it was reported to us that criminals have been, I don't think they've been successful, but they have challenged it. And again, it's going to tie us up. It's going to tie up the courts where they have challenged a ruling of homicide in an attempt to get it to an accident or a suicide. Obviously, that would wreck all sorts of unfortunate issues on if this case was on appeal, which it would be.
But don't the coroner usually go in and testify at the murder trial? I mean, wouldn't it be very easy to deal with that collateral attack? Pretty simply?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, no, it would not, because the burden of proof is lower in a civil case. In a criminal case, I've got to prove that person was killed beyond a reasonable doubt. In a civil case, if this is attacked collaterally, it's preponderance of the evidence, it's clear and convincing, it's whatever, but it's a lesser standard than beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's going to be easier to prove that, no, it wasn't homicide, it was suicide.
But then you'd still have to go back to court and challenge the criminal conviction in a, but we don't, this is yeah. not, we don't need to go down this path. So,
we're in
court. Okay. Mr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Golden, the Director of Health Policy at the Department of Health.
Yes, and the question is, the administrative, could the department administratively address these issues?
Mr. Chair, committee members, administratively, there would not be much difference in the amount of work at the Ed Department. From the department, we are the recorder of the fact and maintain that in our records. If the facts come to us from a physician, medical examiner, or a court, realistically, from the standpoint of operational feasibility, there's not much difference for us at the department from just the workload.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. I think probably you're the right person to ask this of. Right now, if my mother dies in a nursing home and I look at the death certificate and I go, oh my goodness, this is just wrong. The cause of death is wrong. What is my recourse at the present time? Who would I, would I try to go back to the physician and say you made a mistake and, or what would be my process right now?
Mr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, yes, right now, if you didn't agree with that, you would go back to the physician. I suppose if there were additional concerns with that, you might be able to take it to the county medical examiner. But it would be through those channels. That's where we would refer you back to.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would the county medical examiner would have the authority to fix it if it was just an obvious mistake? That's how that would happen?
Mr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, yes.
Further questions for the department? Okay, thank you. Representative Emmer?
Just in closing, I want to make it clear that judges will not be making medical decisions. This is where you would have to have two different medical opinions, and we do this all the time. This is what the courts do. And this is a lot of, I think, we're taking and making an emotional issue out of the court system when we've had 25 years of experience in Wisconsin in 10 cases. You know, I don't believe that someone will finish with, if this is law, that somebody will say, if you disagree with me, you can take me to court. It's just not the way it works. But in our system, we're supposed to have some remedy. Right now, there is absolutely no remedy whatsoever. I don't want to rehash what we did last year. There are two competing opinions, and there has to be some remedy to resolve those two competing opinions. That's all we're asking for, is a remedy that's missing in the system.
All right. Seeing no further discussion. Representative Emmer renews his motion that House 2752 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. We're going to be voting now, so use your voices, please. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
All right, I'm going to do a division on it. I can't tell. So if you're in favor, raise your hand. Oh. And if you're opposed, raise your hand. 9 in favor, 6 against. So the motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
All right, Representative Ward. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, do you need a motion?
What?
You need a motion for the bill?
Sure.
I'll move it, please.
All right, President Abler moves that House File 2597 be recommended pass and re-referred to the floor, I guess. Civil Justice? Civil Justice.
And Mr. Chair?
No?
I have a deletional amendment, too, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. And
did you get the delete all?
Yeah, we'll do that in a minute. Yep. Yeah. Okay, to Civil Justice. And Representative Abel will move the delete all to get the bill in the form the author wants it. Should we do that right away?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that would be great.
All right. All in favor of the author's delete all amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. First, thank you to Chair Thiessen and Kate for giving us more time in order to become more informed and educated about this very, very important issue, chronic Lyme disease. This battle is 2 years in the making, and we are finally working toward a meaningful compromise with the Board of Medical Practice. That said, it is my intent to move the bill and lay it over and allow for the testimony to happen today at the hearing.
Okay, and just to clarify, that was the A3 amendment, not a DE amendment, but I think everybody understood that was the case. So that's what's before us. Okay, thank you. Well, proceed with the testifiers, or with, if you want anything more to say.
No, Mr. Chair, we'll lay it over at the end, Ian.
Okay, so Elizabeth Maloney?
Mr. Chair, we'll lay it over at the end?
Yes, we will.
Okay.
That's the plan. Yeah.
All right, Mr. Chair, I'm gonna start, and then we'll bring up my testifiers in order
okay.
here, okay?
Please go ahead, yeah.
Mr. Chair, I know also the chronic Lyme advocates also were thankful for the opportunity to share information, provide education, and answer members' questions and concerns. You all have been given statistical information, like Minnesota being eighth in the nation for the number of reported Lyme cases, and the number of reported Lyme cases in Minnesota increasing by 450% in the last decade, just to mention a few statistics. I want to take a few minutes to explore what House File 2597 is about, and to address the questions and concerns that members I have heard from you on this committee. The bottom line of this bill, the bottom line of HF 2597, is that a patient and his or her doctor should have the right to come up with a treatment plan which will best meet the needs of that individual patient in order for that patient to achieve successful medical results. That's it. No more, no less. I believe this is something we would all want for ourselves and our loved ones as well. I'm assuming you would agree with me on that. So why is this bill so controversial? Well, let me just take a little short trip of 60 years of my life and talk about other diseases and health-related issues which all also had controversy surrounding them. For example, polio, AIDS, smoking, vaccinations of any kind, and even cancer. 6 years ago, my wife was diagnosed with cancer, and one doctor told her, here's the prescribed method of treatment for you, Mrs. Ward, Sally. And another, we went to another opinion, and that doctor said, here's another prescribed method of treatment for you, Sally, 180 degrees apart. Mr. Chair, members, her mode of treatment needed to be decided between her and her doctor based on that doctor's clinical judgment, tests, objective and subjective data, just like House File 2597 proposes. A main part of this controversy involves the Lyme disease guidelines the Infectious Disease Society of America, or IDSA, has established for the doctors and the Board of Medical Practice for our state. The Lyme disease guidelines were established by 14 doctors who all had the same opinion of chronic Lyme and various modes of treatment. As a matter of fact, members, the Attorney General from the state of Connecticut filed an antitrust lawsuit against the IDSA due to the fact that the opposing viewpoints were never part of that process. These guidelines, members, don't even recognize chronic Lyme as a disease, and they basically only talk about one method of treatment. This has made doctors reluctant to treat Lyme for the fear of being reprimanded or punished by the Board of Medical Practice. This has also led to doctors brave enough to treat Lyme disease patients to being swamped and having to turn Lyme patients away. Marty, a chronic Lyme diagnosed disease patient, recently shared with me that she tried to get into a Lyme doctor in Duluth and one in St. Cloud, only to be told that those docs were not taking any new Lyme patients due to their overload. Marty is going to Missouri to receive treatment in early March to get medical attention there. To me, members, Mr. Chair, that's wrong. Marty should be able to receive treatment right here in Minnesota. We need to allow the doctors and his or her patient to determine the best treatment plan suited for that individual patient. So, members, let me get to the four questions I heard from you most. What does the science say about Lyme disease? Members, I referenced some diseases early in my testimony that had science all over the place as well. Polio, AIDS, other things like that. The science on this can find research on both sides of this issue. However, members, please listen to these real people with this real disease. Just look around and into the eyes of these people around you, and you will see chronic Lyme really does exist. The second question, no doctor has ever been reprimanded or punished in the state of Minnesota, so what's the problem? Can't the status quo just work? The fact is, as previously stated, many docs refuse to treat Lyme due to the concern about being consequently punished, while others that do treat Lyme patients are swamped and filled up. Question number three, what about the slippery slope of the legislator getting involved in the medical decisions? This bill, again, members, only allows for a doctor and a patient to decide the mode of treatment best suited for that individual patient without the doctor having to fear being reprimanded or punished. The status quo, members, in my opinion, has the IDSA and the Board of Medical Practice practicing medicine. There's no slippery slope here for these folks, these real people with this real disease. Rather, there's just a fast speedway to devastating and declining health without early and proper treatment. Question number four, I am concerned about setting a precedent in the future. That's what I heard from you. I'm concerned about setting a precedent in the future. Well, members, I want to tell you that a precedent has been set with the Intractable Pain Statute 152.125. Believe me, members, which also talks about docs being reprimanded by the Board of Medical Practice with prescribed methods of treatment. Believe me, members, these real people with this real disease, they don't want to be precedent setters either. Their future is just trying to get through each and every day. They hope and pray that you and I, or our spouses, or our kids, or our grandkids, or anyone in our family that we love, never have to be precedent setters like them. However, members, we're all only one tick bite away from that. Recently, and I will conclude here, I was asked by one of Lyme advocates if we as lawmakers have our minds made up before we come to our committee hearings. You know what, members? Here's what I told that Lyme advocate. I replied that maybe some of us do, but and you showed this to be true, members, as we postponed this committee, and you did your research, and you, as the Lyme advocates, gave you that information. I replied that maybe some members do, but in my opinion, most of my colleagues do their homework prior to committee, and then listen and evaluate their decision based on what they hear during the committee today. Members, I know you will do that. I appreciate that you will do that. I respect that you will do that. And now I'm going to have the rest of my testifiers tell the rest of the story, members. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and then proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. I'm Dr. Betty Maloney. I'm a family physician from Wyoming.
Please proceed. Yeah.
Aside from my clinical work, I've had administrative roles in hospitals and clinics. I've created and implemented and overseen healthcare policies and practices. I don't make a living treating Lyme patients because my focus is education. I've been published in several journals, and my recent physician course on Lyme disease is accredited by the American Academy of Family Physicians. I'm not a fringe element, misinformed, or preying on the vulnerable. HF 2597 is about providing a level playing field for physicians who treat Lyme, ensuring that Board of Medical Practice policies don't enforce a false standard. There are many unknowns in Lyme. To address them, two groups have issued philosophically distinct sets of Lyme disease guidelines. These are private groups, not government-sponsored or created. The guidelines are called voluntary, but that's questionable. The IDSA is the larger, better-known organizations. Their guidelines are well-known, but the problems with them aren't. Patient complaints about how these guidelines were used is what prompted the Attorney General of Connecticut's investigation. He found significant process problems which likely impacted the recommendations. The IDSA calls the guidelines evidence-based, but 54% of their recommendations are based on panel opinion. One can see why the patients cried foul. The settlement agreement stipulated a complete review by a new conflict-free panel, a process for new evidence submission, and a public hearing. I authored 40% of the analysis that ILAD submitted to that review panel, so I'm familiar with the issues. Why does any of this matter? Well, in other states, the IDSA guidelines are cited by medical boards to restrict care and punish physicians. To my knowledge, no other set of medical guidelines are used in this fashion. Physicians who are aware of this threat shy away from non-IDSA approaches, which decreases access to treatment alternatives. As I said, I've studied the science underlying both sets of guidelines, and these are some of the things that I've found. Here in Minnesota, many patients have late neurologic Lyme, and the IDSA opposes treatment beyond 28 days. Yet this severe restriction is based on scant data, and only 7 to 35% of the patients return to their pre-Lyme state. None of the four trials treated longer or with combinations of antibiotics. Perhaps doing so would give better results, but we simply do not know. And persistence is well documented in the literature if you know where to look. Now here's an example of why the blood tests don't work. This is a CDC study on commonly used blood tests. Some people like to say that the tests are very reliable in late disease and less so in early. But this study shows that during the rash phase, that the test is more often wrong than right, and that's why we tell physicians, by the way, not to test then. However, it misses neurologic Lyme as well. Only in arthritis does it meet the expectations that we would have for a test. Case reports and studies of late neurologic and chronic Lyme disease demonstrate that prolonged treatment and retreatment helps some patients. of the four NIH-funded trials, two found subsets of patients that did benefit from retreatment. The other two trials, which were by Klempner, were actually fatally flawed and can't be used to draw conclusions. The IDSA portrays antibiotics as the boogeyman. They aren't. Antibiotics have a proven safety record. Serious side effects are rare. Risks can be mitigated. They are used long-term in other diseases. It's not intended for Lyme patients to be on lifelong IV antibiotics. Concerns about resistance should be focused elsewhere. This burden shouldn't be placed on patients suffering with a known infection. The science and antibiotic arguments don't hold up. Don't be misled by the New England Journal of Medicine article from October of 2007. It was written by IDSA panel members who were under investigation at the time. It did not offer new data. It merely speculated that evidence for the existence of persistent or chronic Lyme was tainted and that certain government-certified labs were unreliable. My rebuttal letter to that article was published in January of 2008. Now, what's the evidence for alternative approaches? Well, first, some of the best evidence is that there are poor outcomes under the IDSA-approved regimens. If you define success as a return to your pre-Lyme baseline and use a currently accepted statistical methodology, success rates for early Lyme are around 60% and much lower for late neurologic Lyme. B. burgdorferi, which is the Lyme disease bacteria, avoids being killed in many ways. It can go inside cells, especially nerve cells, where it's safe from the immune system and many antibiotics. And CDC research showed it can do this. When antibiotics get into cells where B. burgdorferi is hiding, it pumps them out. The bacteria can shift to an alternative form that's unharmed by commonly used antibiotics. It reverts back to the typical corkscrew form when the threat passes. Science and medicine shouldn't be subject to the rule of the majority. They should be governed by evidence. The pursuit of evidence-based medical therapies requires physicians to act based on the evidence at hand, but it does not imply that physicians should adhere to ineffective treatments pending future research. Patients should drive treatment decisions. That's the idea behind informed consent. And basically, the pros and cons of therapeutic options are laid out, and the patient chooses. The AMA promotes this as a patient right. But if physicians misunderstand science or feel threatened by the board, they won't provide meaningful informed consent. Minnesotans with Lyme lack easy access to their choice of care. One obstacle they face is physician fear. There should have been a letter from Gina Empey's given to you that states this very thing. Limited physician resources result in treatment delays and a need to travel, yielding poorer outcomes at greater cost. If board policies and procedures fuel this fear, then it's indirectly causing harm. This bill does not force any particular treatment agenda on patients, physicians, or insurers. Patients are free to choose their physicians and treatment plans that meet their needs and goals. Physicians are not forced to treat, but they're free to treat based on clinical judgment. Insurance coverage is not mandated. In fact, this bill is silent with regards to insurance. Based on my prior administrative roles, it seems to me that creating policies to improve patient access is in precedent setting in the overall framework of achieving healthcare goals. Legislation eliminating financial obstacles to care and legislation aimed at redistributing physicians within the state have already been written. HF 2597 is similar, seeking to increase a scarce health care resource by removing obstacles that keep physicians from treating Lyme disease. Lyme disease is a growing problem in our state. Current understanding is too limited to restrict options, but that's what the IDSA guidelines do. Some physicians are concerned the board would use the guidelines to sanction them. This perceived threat creates a domino effect which harms patients. The bill doesn't create mandates or set precedents. Please pass this legislation. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Dr. Mullen, can you talk about the informed consent? Is there anything, this is just a discussion, there's no form laid out saying this potential treatment is inconsistent with DSA guidelines or anything like that?
Well, actually, the physicians I know who do what I would call aggressive antibiotic therapy, they do specifically state that this is not what the IDSA guidelines say. So they are very, very clear that I'm going in this direction, and here's the science I'm using, but here is what other guidelines have said. So I have to tell you that this is the physicians I know that do it. They're very cautious and very clear about laying out the options. They also lay out the risks of doing nothing.
Representative Garner.
Just as a follow-up, how would a skeptic know? I mean, we're all sort of lay people here trying to learn as much as we can.
Right.
And let's say someone at the board, let's just say there's some frivolous complaint or something like that. How would one of those doctors say, I did, and let this person know what the risks and benefits were and that it's outside the guidelines?
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's part of the medical record. That would be an informed consent form that's in the chart. If I can add one more thing, in fact, the physicians I know who use IV antibiotics, so they're going to have a IV access, which does increase risk, they actually have a separate form for that. So they really are trying to cover those things.
Okay, so just as a final question, so in the delete all, you're saying that Representative Ward, that it says nothing shall prohibit from imposing action if you fail to complete or keep complete and accurate records, and so that would include the consent, the informed consent.
That's correct, Representative
Mr. Chair. Ward, yes.
Representative Gardner, that's correct.
Okay, Representative Root.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Ward. You do a great job of representing the people in your district and the concerns that they bring to you. I have a question for the physician. I'm just curious, when you code, is there a CPT code for chronic Lyme disease? And do your patients that you do prescribe, do they have difficulty getting approval for the antibiotic that you may prescribe for chronic Lyme disease?
Doctor.
Thank you. I want to point out that I'm not treating. The physicians who do treat code with the Lyme disease code. And with regards to coverage, it's all over the map because I know within our state that Medica and Preferred One cover. And so it's interesting.
They cover the long-term okay, antibiotics. Okay. Representative Butt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Maloney. And yes, also, Representative Ward did a great job of introducing this. And Dr. Maloney, I saw the presentation over the interim in our joint Senate-House hearing on this as well and heard you speak at that time. I have a couple questions in terms of the described problem, and then this particular bill is the response to that. It seems to me that, particularly from the many emails received, there's often an initial mention of the fact that it took a long time to find treatment or it took many years to get the proper diagnosis. So it seems to me, from all I've heard and read for the last many months, that it's a very difficult thing to even diagnose correctly, even in the early stages, but certainly when it's been delayed, very difficult to diagnose. It seems to me in this issue of not having enough supply of physicians willing to treat chronic Lyme disease, or even necessarily Lyme disease generally, that the explanation being given to us is because there's a fear of sanction, and therefore so there's reduction of doctors willing to do this. But to me, there's two possible other explanations, and what I'm not able to do in this discussion is sort out the impact of these three different possibilities. So one is there's not enough doctors because there's a fear of sanctions. The other is that the it's possible that the majority of doctors might actually agree with the ISDA guidelines and therefore don't offer to treat patients who say they are coming because of chronic Lyme disease. Because they don't provide that treatment or take those patients because they don't agree. They might agree with the other perspective. And then the third one might be because of the complexity of many of these cases, particularly if it's been going on for years, is they don't feel competent to treat these patients. And so it strikes me that all three of those things could explain the inadequate supply of physicians in this area. And if either you or presenters coming up after you or Dick Auld from the Board of Medical Practice could address how we can sort out those three things, I would appreciate that.
Representative Ward.
Again, thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Representative Bunn, great questions, and probably all of those factors definitely impact treatment for chronic Lyme and Lyme. And I think I said earlier in my presentation that Mr. Auld, we have been working, Dr. Maloney, myself, and Mr. Auld have been working on a compromise agreement that I think he will talk about as well in his presentation, and I think that addresses some of these issues.
Representative Tao. Oh, if you want to address the question.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Bunn. What was interesting to me is I think your points, you do hit all the possibilities are in play. When I gave my first course on Lyme disease to physicians, really I could only get a few of them to come, to be quite honest. But about half of them now are much more aggressive about diagnosing, and they are involved in co-managing patients, taking some of the easier ones. So I think there's a learning curve. And physicians always have an option to not want to go in a certain direction, and I think that's fine. But I just want, if we can encourage physicians by education to realize that they're on safe footing, then I'd like to do that as well.
President Tao.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ward and Dr. Maloney. I'm sympathetic to the patients who don't have access to this technique. It seems like the issue seems to be more about access. If this bill passes, are there doctors out there that will be willing to use this method, or are we just assuming or hoping that there will be some out there?
Doctor.
Thank you, Representative. I've been told by physicians that they would be more willing to treat if they didn't have to look over their shoulder. And Dr. Kara Parker at Hennepin County thought that she does some Lyme in her practice, but she thought that more of her colleagues would take on Lyme patients if this bill were in place.
Mr. Chair and Representative Tao, I think some of the Lyme patients themselves that we're going to hear from in a minute can even address that question, because that is a very good question, and it is our belief that we are going to improve access to the medical profession for chronic Lyme folks.
Representative Gawa?
Okay. I'll wait until after.
The settlement in Connecticut, is that, it was challenged, right? What's the status of that?
They had the hearing. They've had this evidence submission, which I was part of. We're waiting for their review panel to reach their decision. Their original goal had been by the end of 2009. And then recently there's been some messages from the Attorney General to the IDSA because they weren't apparently following the voting procedures that had been set out in the settlement. And so I think that's probably delayed things again.
Okay. And so this is the tick. It's a bacterial infection?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the bacteria stays in the system then for an extended period of time? Is that why?
Yes, and that's one of the problems, because even in the research by Logigian on people who had late neurologic Lyme, one of the things he found is that first, some of his patients in that study had been treated for early Lyme and yet continued to go downhill.
and ended up in his study. And the other thing that he found was that there seemed to be certain periods, like it took 1.5 years to get to where your peripheral nerves, maybe you lost sensation, and it took about 2.5 years to get to a point where you're starting having trouble with your thinking so that you're losing cognitive faculties. And then ultimately there is concern that this can even lead to dementia because they have found Borrelia in autopsy specimens of people with the diagnosis of dementia.
All right. Thank you very much. Go ahead. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Michelle Backus from Lindstrom, Minnesota. I'm a wife, I'm a mom, I'm a teacher, coach, and chaplain for our Minnesota Lynx WNBA team. I'm also one of the many thousands of Minnesotans that have suffered from Lyme disease. I was bit by a tick in 2006 and contracted Lyme disease. Kind of a clear-cut slam dunk case, which was very nice, understanding the controversial behind it that I didn't know of. And I took the prescribed doxycycline for the designated amount of time and felt fine. 3 months later, I noted numbness on my lip, and within 48 hours, my whole right side, my arm, my face, and my leg was numb. Within a couple of weeks, I couldn't walk. I could not see out of my left eye. I had terrible vertigo, relentless vomiting, fatigue, and brain fog. And I spent 5 days in the hospital. The MRIs of my brain showed brain lesions, and I was diagnosed with MS. It just didn't make sense to me. Yet, I was laughed out of every neurologist's office whenever I inquired about Lyme. But after doing my own research, I concluded that my symptoms were probably and likely a progression of my Lyme 3 months earlier. Unfortunately, I could not find a doctor in the state to treat me. I saw a Missouri physician specializing on Lyme and was on oral antibiotics for over a year. I have been off antibiotics for 3.5 years. I am now symptom-free and have no new brain lesions. Last summer, I even finished Grandma's marathon. Now, meet Chris Erickson. He's an IT consultant and outdoorsman who had a tick bite resulting in a resulting rash go unrecognized as Lyme. Instead, at age 14, he was diagnosed with a rare juvenile onset Parkinson's. He went untreated for the next 18 years. 18 years until his own research suggested a Lyme diagnosis, which was later confirmed. Like me, he couldn't get help in Minnesota and had to go elsewhere. After 11 months of a combination of oral antibiotics, and all of his symptoms are gone. He has been off of all treatment for over 5 years, an amazing medical case. And lastly, 15-year-old Chris Thompson. He didn't know he was even bitten by a tick when he got a fever and fatigue. His doctor found a ehrlichiosis infection, which is a Lyme co-infection, and was treated for 3 weeks. But testing had missed the Lyme. 1 month later, a constant severe headache, fatigue, and muscle tension brought this previously active and healthy kid to an abrupt stop. Once Lyme was found, his parents searched for physicians willing to treat. Like Chris Erickson and me, they've had to leave the state of Minnesota for care. Chris is early into his treatment and slowly getting better. I hope you all never have to be in our situation. It could possibly be a tick bite away. Please consider our stories and many other stories and vote yes on this bill. Thank you.
Questions? So are there, it sounds like there are some doctors who are treating extended Lyme in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, yes, I've been told and led to be, and Dr. Maloney would know better than I, but Marty, who is in the audience, went to a doc up in Duluth and a doc in St. Cloud that treats extended Lyme, and they're swamped. They're overbooked. They don't take any more new ones. Okay. We have two more testifiers, yes. Mr. Chair.
Please proceed.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Laura Keller, and I'm a pharmacist and co-chair for the Professional Affairs Committee for the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. I also have a business partner that has suffered from chronic Lyme disease. Lyme disease is a rapidly growing healthcare concern for the citizens of Minnesota, where it is endemic in many areas. Patients who are not adequately treated are often so debilitated they're unable to work or function as productive members of society. I am here today to support HF-2597. Like many diseases, the clinical diagnosis of Lyme disease is based on symptoms, clinical examination, and laboratory testing. This bill allows physicians to practice medicine on a case-by-case basis using their unique skill set, interpretation of the medical literature, and experience to determine an appropriate treatment plan. The fear of board investigation and peer review should not deter physicians from treating their Lyme patients according to the best clinical judgment. There is not sufficient scientific evidence to prohibit the use of long-term antibiotic therapy for Lyme disease. Antibiotic resistance should not be a concern in high-dose long-term therapy being used. Many antibiotics used to treat chronic Lyme disease are very inexpensive and have safe side effect profiles. In contrast, anti-inflammatory and other medications used to treat fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, rheumatoid arthritis, which are common misdiagnoses, are often more expensive and have many unwanted side effects. In summary, this bill is important to ensure that physicians and other providers are able to treat their patients using their professional clinical judgment. They should not be restricted or micromanaged by insurers, institutions, and the medical board for using FDA-approved medications that are within their scope of practice. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to draw attention to the need to protect access to quality health care for citizens of the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I just have a question about your comment about the resistance. And I understand that some of the drugs that are used to prescribe are cost-effective. They're not necessarily expensive drugs. But I guess I would be concerned because as a provider, we try to prescribe the lowest-cost drugs that are available. So to me, that would mean that they're more widely utilized. So why don't we need to be concerned about resistance with the use of long-term antibiotic use for Lyme?
Mr. Chair and Representative, generally our concern with resistance is if we do short-term therapies or low-dose therapies so that when we are not adequately killing off the bugs in the system, they're then able to recognize that antibiotic and change so that they can no longer be affected by the antibiotic. In Lyme disease treatment, we're generally using high enough doses and we are treating for long enough that you would adequately kill off all of that bacteria, therefore decreasing the risk for resistance.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the dose? What are the milligrams?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the doses are patient-specific, so it would be dependent upon the stage that you are representing with or your weight, your build, so generally across the board, and medication-dependent. We have multiple medications that are used, so whichever medication would be chosen, again, it would be a physician up to the physician's discretion to pick that dose. But they're usually using high enough doses that we are penetrating and killing that bacteria.
And to that point, and so if you were giving 400,000 units of Y-Selen or something of that order, is that sort of the margin of dose or and higher for long periods of time? Okay. And that would be why the physicians are afraid. Okay. Would that be correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I I don't believe that the physicians are afraid to use the doses of antibiotics that they're using. We use that for multiple other disease states as well. I believe it's just specific to chronic Lyme disease.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Before our last testifier takes a couple minutes here, two or three minutes, I just want to recognize Representative Bob Demmer, who also has been instrumental in helping this bill in the last 2 years. So appreciate his advocacy as well. So our last testifier, Mr. Chair, and then thank you so much and being gracious and patient with us, chairman members. Thank you very much.
Pastor Stenberg.
Thank you for allowing me to speak on behalf of the Lyme people of Minnesota and beyond. My name is Art Stenberg, and I'm from Buffalo, Minnesota, and I'm 77 years old. I grew up as a hard-working son of a successful farmer. I've owned my own business and served on numerous company and community boards. I served as a chaplain and eventually became a pastor, and along with a wonderful and supportive wife, raised three wonderful children. And I have chronic Lyme. The little spirochetes got into my system, and they can bore through flesh, and they get into a corpuscle, and I pull this thing around them, so antibiotics normally can't get to them. I was bitten by a deer tick while living in Brainerd, Minnesota in 83, 27 years ago. And at the time, I was working as an operations analyst for a hardware chain. My first symptoms were fatigue, severe headaches, muscle and joint aches, light rash, and a low-grade fever, which lasted from September until March, 18 months later. My family doctor referred me to the Mayo Clinic, diagnosis fever unknown origin, otherwise known as FUO, and was told you'll either get better or you'll get worse. That was their diagnosis for me. Over time, never feeling normal, I was forced to quit working as I was unable to stand or carry my books and luggage into the motels. At that time, I was serving 14 states and going to the hardware stores and helping diagnose problems. But I couldn't get my luggage into the motels anymore. I sought help from physical therapy, the fibromyalgia clinic, neurologists, psychiatrists, and orthopedic doctors. The orthopedist referred me to an infectious disease clinic where the doctor suspected and presumed I had Lyme disease. After two courses of antibiotics, 76 days in total, that was IV antibiotics, I began to show some improvement. I was once again scheduled for another course of antibiotics, but the day before I was to begin that treatment, I received a call and was abruptly refused any more treatment and told me to go see a psychiatrist. After the refusal, I continued to have severe pain all over, and 9 years later, in 1992, we traveled to Long Island, New York, my wife and I, to see Dr. Joseph Barascano, one of the key people as far as Lyme is concerned, and he declared that I had Lyme. But he could not obtain IV therapy here in Minnesota. They wouldn't allow long-term, you see. As I exhausted medical resources, I decided to now treat the pain through a pain clinic. Over several years, the pain was reduced, but the narcotics doses got too high for me. Then, almost like a miracle, I was told of a Medtronic pain pump which disperses tiny amounts of pain medication intraecally, pardon my Norwegian, over 24. You see, I got two strikes against me. I'm Norwegian, I got Lyme brain. Presently, I rely on my pain pump to alleviate much of the pain, which allows me to live a somewhat normal life. And I go in every 30 days into the university, and they fill this pump here in my belly. And that gets morphine into my spinal column, cuts down the pain. Otherwise, I'd be a total invalid at this time. Through these years, as I searched for answers, the doctors searched for the cause. The multiple tests I received included Lyme, MRI, CT, 5 angiograms, because spirochetes get into the heart and the brain, and so the heart is affected. Microvessel spasms, EMG echo, myelogram, cardio stress test, thermography, lupus, spinal taps, bone marrow, colon x-ray, hip x-rays, endoscopy, IgG and IgM. You know, if you survive the test, you'll be okay.
And we, well, we do have to, we have a lot of other, we have many other testifiers yet to go, so we need to wrap up quickly, if you could.
All, even when repeated, proved normal, except for a natural killer cell count, which was low. I have suffered. I live daily with pain and brain fog and short-term memory loss. And my wife has suffered as well as she has taken on the role of caretaker and struggled to help me deal with my pain. This disease has cost us our life's savings and taken an even worse toll on our time and energy that I've been able to spend with my family. They lost their energetic and vibrant father a long time ago. Somewhere there is a breakdown in communication. Evidence from numerous doctors across the country have agreed that the only way to eradicate the Lyme disease spirochetes is through long-term treatment. There are so many people suffering and so many more that have just plain given up. It is time to allow doctors to treat chronic Lyme. It is time to allow doctors to be doctors.
Amen. Thank you. Representative Gottwald had a question.
Mr. Chair, if we have a whole line of testifiers, I wanted to ask some questions associated with the bill in general. So if you want to keep moving through testifiers, okay. I can ask my question.
Thank
later.
You. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is just to the author of the bill, regarding something that you mentioned during the different testimonies. I'm just curious, you referenced a doctor in Duluth that is swamped because of, you know, the people that are desperate for this treatment and can't find it anywhere else. Has that doctor or is that doctor facing any disciplinary action, any consequences because of his willingness to treat long-term Lyme disease, or what are the repercussions of this one doctor in Minnesota doing this?
President Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Mack. Thank you for the question. And to my knowledge, he is not facing any. No doctor in Minnesota has ever faced any repercussions, and so that's, you know, we say why can't we just continue with the status quo? Because it has cut off access to these patients, to these people, real people with real disease. So, and I think the Board of Medical Practice is going to address that as well. Thank you.
And thank you for coming down. And so the next testifier is Dr. Alt. And Representative Ward, at some point, I mean, I think the flip side of that question is doctors who are not going to treat, and I, maybe the testifiers talked about that briefly, but that there are doctors who refuse to treat because they're afraid of consequences. We don't have to, at some point, we should address that a little bit. Okay. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dick Auld. I'm the Assistant Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice, and I must confess to suffering from the same condition that Pastor Stenberg suffers from. I have Norwegian brain, so forgive me. We at the board, at the staff level and at the board level, all recognize, first off, that there are many patients who have had numerous very, very difficult health issues and that they have encountered great frustration in obtaining care that addresses those conditions. So I just want everyone to understand that we do have interests of patients in mind. Last year, the board opposed this bill. I think it was under a different number and slightly different language, but it was the same concept. Our board has not had an opportunity to form an official position on this bill yet this year. However, thank you to Representative Huntley for inviting us and Representative Ward for inviting us to present our experience on this, and thank you to Representative Thiessen for allowing us to be on the agenda. I want to cover a couple of areas that have been mentioned already and then discuss some of the reasons that we did oppose this bill last year. First of all, it's been mentioned there's been no disciplinary action against any physician in Minnesota by the Board of Medical Practice. That's the truth. There have been no investigations. There have been no other actions by our board regarding this issue. In point of fact, we've never received a complaint on this issue. If we had received a complaint and had investigated it, the IDSA guidelines are only that. They are guidelines, and they would be included among other kinds of evidence that our board would take into consideration. Nor would a likely outcome of any such investigation be something as punitive as a suspension or a revocation, but more likely to take the form of some kind of educational course. The bill, as drafted, does raise some real difficulties for us, and we addressed these last year, and the board no doubt will have the same concerns this year. First of all, it is a mandated standard of care. I know there are folks who disagree with that concept, but it does, by default, mandate a standard of care. Secondly, it's a specific carve-out of our authority at the board to enforce our statute, which is Minnesota Chapter 147. And this specific carve-out represents a very dangerous avenue for additional carve-outs in the future that could take the form of just about anything one could imagine. It's the proverbial slippery slope that could result basically in Chapter 147 being unenforceable. There have been a couple of things mentioned that are parallel. One is the intractable pain statute. That is a statute that we assisted in drafting and supported when it was passed by the legislature some years ago. It has a significant difference from what the language in this bill contains. It has a clause that says nothing in the statute will prohibit the board from enforcing Minnesota Chapter 147. This bill says that, but then gives two specific portions of Chapter 147 that the board can enforce. That is ongoing monitoring and record keeping. And those are included in what we have the jurisdiction over, but not the only things. So this language significantly differs from the intractable pain statute. Representative Ward has been very kind to invite us into. Representative Ward has been very kind to invite us into some negotiations that have been taking place the last few days, and very cooperative in providing us information on approaches to this problem that might result in a non-legislative resolution. And we want to thank Representative Ward for that and others who have been involved. We do think that we have a proposal which we can bring to our board at its next meeting, which is March 13th, for their review and approval. It is a resolution drafted by our staff, which we would present to the board as an alternative to a statute which I'm sure they're going to find objectionable. I think that the resolution that we have addresses a number of the concerns that the testifiers have raised today, and certainly a number of the concerns that we at the board have. I'll be happy to take any questions.
President Gardner.
Thank you. Mr. Auld, can you just tell us what triggers a viable complaint that goes beyond just a preliminary checkup or investigation? Is one of those things prescribing treatment that seems to succeed even though it's outside industry guidelines of some kind?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, there's a very elaborate complaint review system that we have that's basically prescribed by the Administrative Procedures Act. We have the obligation under statute to investigate all complaints that are brought to us. The internal process that we use comprises a number of different steps, the first of which is assembling documentation regarding the complaint by the board staff. It's then reviewed by consultants whom we have, who are physicians, who address medical issues and suggest to the staff and to the complaint review committee other avenues to pursue or ways of disposing of the issue. It then goes to a complaint review committee. That committee is comprised of two physicians and one public member. They review the issue. If they determine that there is no problem, this is dismissed and the case is closed. If they see some other issues that need to be pursued, they are investigated. Eventually, a physician could be brought in for a conference with that committee, and that could result in the committee proposing basically a negotiated settlement with them. It's called a stipulation and order. That then would be presented to the full board if the physician signs off. If the physician doesn't sign off, it could go to a contested case proceeding before an administrative law judge. A very elaborate process that's designed specifically to give due process to the parties.
And consent, how does that play in there? If in fact all the risks are disclosed of a particular kind of treatment, does that mitigate?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, the issue of informed consent would be a part of the record that is assembled by our staff and by others who might be investigating this and is considered in the process by the committee. So, yes, informed consent would be a considerable part of this.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, thank you for coming down.
Thank you.
Ms. Lynn, Dr. Linfield, and Ms. Brace, if you want to come down too, just so we can. We only have about 10 minutes to go here. And again, just if people came in and out, this is going to be laid on the table at the end of our discussion.
Chairman Thiessen and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Ruth Linfield. I am the state epidemiologist and the medical director of the MDH's Division of Infectious Disease, Epidemiology Prevention and Control. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on House File 2597. I appreciate the testimony of the Minnesotans who have come before you today to share their experiences. The illnesses that they have suffered have seriously impacted their lives and the lives of their families. MDH has a long history of work on Lyme disease. We have conducted statewide surveillance on this disease for 27 years. We also provide recommendations for Lyme disease and for other tick-borne diseases in the areas of prevention, control, diagnosis, and treatment. Lyme disease is a potentially serious disease caused by an infection with the bacterium Borrelia burgdorferi. Prompt diagnosis and proper antibiotic treatment can prevent its most severe manifestations. Evidence-based scientific literature indicates that appropriate antibiotics
given for 10 to 28 days kill the bacteria that cause Lyme disease. However, in certain unusual cases of Lyme arthritis, the Infectious Disease Society of America treatment guidelines for Lyme disease discuss an additional 2 to 4 week course of antibiotics. Unfortunately, some people who have had Lyme disease are impacted by symptoms, particularly those of severe fatigue and pain, even when they no longer have an active infection. It is recognized that the response to treatment with antibiotics may be slow, and it may take months to improve after antibiotic treatment is completed. However, antibiotics are not indicated when there is no longer an active bacterial infection, and the medical literature does not support the use of long-term, many months or years of antibiotics to treat Lyme disease. Some physicians refer to these patients as having post-Lyme syndrome. A review of the issue of chronic Lyme disease published in the New England Journal of Medicine concluded that the assumption that chronic subjective symptoms are caused by persistent infection with B. burgdorferi is not supported by carefully conducted laboratory studies or by controlled treatment trials. Chronic Lyme disease, which is equated with chronic B. burgdorferi infection, is a misnomer. And the use of prolonged, dangerous, and expensive antibiotic treatment for it is not warranted. In clinical science, the gold standard for evaluating treatment effectiveness is a randomized, prospective, placebo-controlled trial in which patients with similar symptoms are assigned to a treatment group and a placebo group and followed to compare differences in outcomes. The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease at the National Institutes of Health has stated regarding chronic Lyme disease that carefully designed placebo-controlled studies have failed to demonstrate that prolonged antibiotic therapy is beneficial. Although isolated success stories are always good to hear, such reports alone are not sufficient grounds to support a therapeutic approach. A positive response to prolonged antibiotic therapy may be due to the placebo effect, which was reported in as high as 40% in the studies described above. In addition, long-term antibiotic therapy can have negative consequences. Long-term antibiotics put people at risk for a number of serious and sometimes fatal consequences, including bloodstream infections as a result of indwelling intravenous lines. We are aware of a patient who died from a fungal blood infection as a result of prolonged antibiotic treatment for chronic Lyme disease. In addition, other severe or fatal adverse effects include Clostridium difficile infections as a result of prolonged antibiotic exposure, severe allergic reactions, interactions between medications, and adverse effects directly due to the toxicity of the antibiotics. In fact, the Minnesota Department of Health recently investigated a case of Clostridium difficile that all too tragically demonstrates these adverse consequences. Recently, a middle-aged Minnesota woman died about 5 weeks into her second course of antibiotics, which was given to treat chronic Lyme disease. This woman developed fulminant colitis due to Clostridium difficile bacteria. What happens is antibiotics killed normal intestinal flora and allowed overgrowth of this toxin-producing bacteria that in turn caused her fatal illness. From a public health standpoint, MDH is also very concerned about the increasing problem of antibiotic-resistant bacteria and the critical need to use antibiotics judiciously. Exposure to antibiotics can be associated with the development of resistance among other bacteria in the individual
that may result in an increased risk of resistant infections both for that individual and for the community. Resistant infections can be very difficult to treat and may require the use of intravenous and more toxic antibiotics. Lastly, MDH is concerned because the symptoms that may be treated as chronic Lyme disease may, in some cases, have other causes. It is important that these symptoms are carefully evaluated so that a patient with another disease with a known effective treatment can receive that treatment. Thank you for your attention to our comments. We empathize with the pain, severe fatigue, and other symptoms that many people associate with the diagnosis of chronic Lyme disease. Scientific studies have not found a long-term benefit to multiple and prolonged courses of antibiotics. However, this does not discount the symptoms of post-Lyme syndrome, which can be very significant. Although antibiotics are not the answer and can be dangerous, we hope that effective treatments can be found to help people suffering from post-Lyme syndrome and other conditions attributed to chronic Lyme disease.
Questions, members?
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
Really short. I'm just amazed that our smartest people are unopen to new and novel things and have opinions like that. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Brace, thank you for coming down, Doctor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Twyla Brace. I'm president of the Citizens Council on Healthcare. I'm also a registered nurse and a public health nurse. And I'm here to speak on behalf of patients and doctors. And I'll have you know that as the hearing went on, I cut out half my testimony. So it's shorter than I came with. Well, it's possible that patients may need you to pass this bill. But our concern with this bill is that we believe it will take the legislature further down the road to defining the practice of medicine from far beyond the exam room. And perhaps on a case-by-case basis and a condition-by-condition basis. And I very much feel for these patients that are stuck in a situation that we feel has been made worse by state laws and rules that have inserted bureaucratic controls over the practice of medicine with the possibility of serious repercussions for doctors who want to treat outside the guidelines and treat patients like they need to be treated. The situation before you could be what we believe might be the first in a long line of individual conditions and cases that will come to the legislature as more doctors are prevented or discouraged by laws and regulations from individualizing the care of patients, and as more patients realize that doctors' hands are being tied by imposed guidelines and that their lives may depend upon securing legislation to untie them and protect them. Last week I was talking to a physician who told me that if his compliance with clinic treatment protocols does not reach a certain percentage rate, his entire clinic may lose the payment that has been withheld from them, dollars they get only if they demonstrate sufficient compliance with protocols, regardless of what the patients may need. Thus, these protocols and guidelines become rules with ramifications. In this case, what if the clinic's protocol for Lyme disease does not mention or specifically discourage antibiotics after 28 days? For instance, the Minnesota Department of Health Lyme disease guideline appears to discourage it by saying, as Dr. Linfield said, there is no scientific evidence to support long-term parenteral therapy. That means injection or intravenous. However, then they admit that control trials have not been done. So do we really know? This Lyme disease bill is probably the tip of the don't penalize my doctor iceberg. In 2008, a law was passed to require the Minnesota Department of Health to track every physician's practice. As of July 6, 2009, health insurers began sending private patient information to the Department of Health without patient consent. Every encounter will be recorded and analyzed. In July of this year, every physician is required to report certain additional information to the department for the purpose of measuring doctors and financially penalizing or rewarding them according to how they measure up with whatever the department says is the practice of medicine should be. Can licensing and disciplinary actions be far behind? Doctors are professionally and ethically beholden to their patients, but this law, Minnesota Statute 62U, breaks that patient-doctor relationship and inserts government and health plan guidelines impacting all patients, including patients with Lyme disease. Now, I'm not coming here to argue for or against this bill. Instead, I recommend undoing the damage done by the 2008 legislation so patients don't have to come to the legislature in the future to ask you to give their doctors permission to be doctors. Otherwise, the Minnesota legislature becomes the arbiter of last resort for patients, and not all of them may get here in time to get what they need. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both of you. Dr. Kravitz. Thanks for your patience. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, Chairman Thiessen and committee members, and Vice Chair Liveling. I'm Dr. Gary Kravitz. I'm a physician, an infectious disease specialist, who's been in practice here in St. Paul for 28 years. In fact, I started practice at the very time that Lyme disease was first reported and recognized in our state. I've personally treated hundreds and hundreds of patients with Lyme disease, and I'm certainly very sympathetic to people who have suffered or believe they're suffering from any form of Lyme disease. Now, we have here people who feel that they have a form of chronic Lyme disease, have been helped by treatment, but I think we're maybe missing a large fraction of people who have been treated for chronic Lyme disease, alleged chronic Lyme disease, and have obtained no benefit. So I think statistically, we're looking at somewhat of a skewed sampling here, and I'm concerned that personal testimonial by individuals is coloring the opinion of you members of the legislature here. Remember, I guess I would be somewhat hesitant to accept at face value people's medical test, unsubstantiated, unsupported medical testimony. And remember that people who are not helped by treatment are not present here today. Also, I'd like to say there's just a study published just yesterday from the physicians at Gunderson Clinic where they looked at over 600 patients who had acute Lyme disease between the year 2000 and 2004. They phoned them, interviewed them, surveyed them, and examined them. And they found that 98% of patients receiving 7 to 14 days of antibiotics achieved a clinical cure. And we're not having any chronic problems whatsoever, because I believe before it was said before this committee that antibiotic therapy is only effective for 60% of the time for acute Lyme disease. At any rate, I represent the North Central chapter of the Infectious Disease Society, and we are 250 physicians and scientists in our area, and we're recognized as an authority in treatment of infectious diseases, not just Lyme disease, in our area. And I just wanted to speak to you briefly about these maligned Lyme guidelines. Again, the idea is that these guidelines, one, the guidelines, they don't claim to have monopoly power. They're guidelines, and adherence is voluntary. Likewise, it hasn't been mentioned, but the American Academy of Neurology had a separate panel of people in the field of Lyme disease in the brain, and lo and behold, they came to the same conclusions as the Infectious Disease Society of America. And indeed, the conclusions of the Lyme guidelines of the Infectious Disease Society have also been accepted by the Centers for Disease Control, the National Institute of Health, the American College of Physicians, and the American Academy of Pediatrics. So I don't quite, just to show you that independent groups have come to similar conclusions, and that, the guidelines are not intended to be a straitjacket on clinical practice. Guidelines are created at the behest of the Institute of Medicine to summarize large volumes of data to allow clinicians to make the best possible judgment for their patients. So in a guideline, it's been said that 60% of the IDSA guidelines were based on expert consensus and not research, and that is correct. However, when you form a guideline, there's three levels of data that you weight. The lowest is a consensus of experts, or, I treated five patients and four of them got better. The next most important is what's called a non-randomized control, where you enroll a series of patients and assess their response. And the highest level of guidance or weight is given to randomized controlled studies, where you give some patients placebo, some patients treatment. The patients are not known, do not know which they got, and assess the results. And the Infectious Disease Society's recommendation about treatment of chronic Lyme disease and the lack of benefit of prolonged antibiotics was based on their assessment of the results of 4 randomized controlled trials. It wasn't based on hearsay, testimony, or in my experience, or my patients always do this. Now, I am a little concerned about some of the things I've heard about we should give doctors the power to do anything they want. Okay, it turns out a lot of medical therapies that have been used in the past.
And we have like a minute.
No, I'll be done.
Yep, okay.
30 seconds.
Sorry.
Are deleterious. Okay, just a few years ago, vitamin E, right, was felt to be really helpful to prevent heart disease and was widely promulgated as a prevent-all for heart disease and stroke. However, when a randomized trial was done, it turned out it had just the opposite effect. So you may think it's great to go to a doctor who's going to give you 800 milligrams a day of vitamin E and won't be dissuaded from the research, but I don't think that's such a good idea. Again, a few years ago, it was thought that estrogens were the greatest thing for postmenopausal women to keep you young. However, studies have shown significant cardiovascular and cancer risks. So your doctor may choose to ignore that and say, you know, I put all my women and ladies on estrogen and they do great. But that I don't think that is the kind of medicine that we want to guarantee by law that you have access to a doctor who is going to give you things that are harmful. So you have to be very cognizant that any medical treatment can have very serious adverse effects, which need be weighed against the potential beneficial effects. Now, I can tell you I've seen numerous serious effects, including deaths from people treated for chronic Lyme disease, and I've seen numerous patients achieve no benefit who were readily improved by treating other identifiable conditions. And that's Mike.
Representative Root has a question.
Thank you. It's not a question, just a quick comment, Mr. Chair, if I may. One of our earlier colleagues made a rather disparaging comment towards Dr. Linfield, and I just want to publicly apologize and let the record reflect that I am grateful for as for one, that we live in a state where we recognize science, we look at evidence-based research, and as a provider myself, I appreciate that what the work that you do at the Department of Health, and I just wanted the record to reflect that. Thank you.
Okay. All right, thank you very much. And we are going to lay the bill over and adjourn.